Eric?
We lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
This one is called clarifying. Express yourself. That is me. Ask yourself each day, what remains unexpressed within me? Whatever it is, bring it out, but be judicious. The rantings of mad people do not yield greater freedom. Those who are with spirit use expression to find greater understanding of themselves and so find liberation from ignorance and circumstance. All that is good and unique in you should be brought out. If you do not do this, you will be stunted. Never hold back, thinking that you will wait for a better time. The good in you is like the water in a well. The more you draw from it, the more fresh water will seep in. If you do not draw from it, the water will only become stagnant. What is dark, perhaps even evil, inside you must be expressed in a proper way too. Lust, hatred, cruelty, and resentment. These must all be carefully taken out of yourself, like finding a bomb and taking it to be detonated harmlessly. Your heart may be quite a minefield, but you must persevere in clearing it if you want to plant crops and frolic without concern. Ask yourself each day, what remains unexpressed within me? Unless you can express it, you will not clarify your inner nature. So here we are in this fifth step, right, where I'm sharing all these terrible garbage things about myself that I swore that I was never going to share with anybody. But I've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with whatever this power is, right? Whatever you've concluded it in. The book talks about being the creator. And then to discover the obstacles in our path. On page 73, it says, more than most people, the alcoholic leaves the double life. That's an inaccurate statement. My experience is that when I was in my alcohol, I was leading the quadruple, sextuple, septuple life. Like, you never get any of the people around me together to compare notes on me because they're all going to be talking about somebody different. That was how I lived. I had adopted this idea somewhere in my life that it was great to be mysterious and not to have anybody know you. But what really was happening is I wasn't expressing myself freely for who I was. You know, what's fascinating to me about me is that forever I was trying to make sure that nobody ever knew me. Because I thought that was neat, right? Some James Bond kind of shit where I was like secret agent and you couldn't ever figure out where I was or who I was or where I was going. I adopted that philosophy and that's how I lived. So much so that even the woman that I was married to had no idea who she was really married to. But here's what's crazy to me. Is that today I've got a slew of inventory in this notebook that is pieces that I've done over time. And if you were here last year, I wrote a piece and read a piece in front of this entire room. Didn't feel compelled to do it this year because there's nothing that's got me burned up right now. But Tarek and I have shared our inventory with tons of people. And we read our inventory to tons of people. And for a guy that used to be so concerned with how you were going to view me, the thing that I've come to realize is that there's going to be some of you that like me. There's going to be some of you that are okay with me. There's going to be some of you that dislike me. There's going to be some of you that really dislike me, and there's going to be some of you that don't really give a shit about me at all. And that's going to be everywhere I go. So why not just be me, the best version of me I can, and realize that if everybody likes me, I'm a phony anyways. Because I'm too busy trying to please everybody, and you're never going to please everybody. And that's what the fifth step has done for me, is it's given me this ability to be me. I'm free to be me. And there are very few places that you go where if you compare notes on Brandon, are you going to find different expressions of me? I'm going to be pretty much the same. And one of the things that I know about myself as a result of this process is I can't afford to not be honest. And that means in the expression of me, that means in my words, that means in so many things. So I have a bunch of guys that'll call me for a 10th step. And they'll share what they've got going on, and they'll ask me what I think. And if I don't know them very well, the question I ask them is, do you really want to know what I think? Which is their way to escape what they're getting ready to hear, which is going to be what I really think. And I'm going to speak honestly. And it might be harsh, but if I want to be a person of integrity, then I have to say what I do and do what I say and mean it. And that was never me ever before I got sober. Because I was always working an angle. I always had a plan. I was always trying to figure out why you were asking me the question that you were asking me, because I need to know what it is in order to answer the question the right way so that you get the information that doesn't make me look like I don't have the information. Now I just answer the question. So much easier. Okay? So we do this fifth step, and then when I'm done reading it, I think that there's a bunch of people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous that they leave out, to me, what is one of the most vital parts of the fifth step. And Tarek referred to it earlier. It's called returning home. It's the last paragraph on page 75. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf. I'm a literalist. I put it on a shelf so I can take it down from the shelf. That's just what I do. We turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. That would be page 59 in this case. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. For we are building the arch through which we shall walk a free man. And they got these four questions at the bottom of the page, right? Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Okay? Maybe those questions don't mean anything to you, so I think that you understand, is our work solid so far, right? Are the stones properly in place? That makes sense too. Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? So when you make concrete, there's four parts. There's water, there's aggregate, there's sand, and there's cement. Okay? It's Portland lime cement. And when that goes into this combination, those four components, there's an actual chemical reaction that happens where they can no longer be separated. Once that becomes concrete, then it is concrete. Now, you can bust up the concrete to create aggregate to use again, but concrete can't ever be separated from concrete. It's concrete, okay? So, but if I don't put the cement in there, then I'm going to have a bunch of sand and rock and water, and that's it. But if I add that special ingredient, that cement, which comes from crushed up marble or limestone, it makes this glue that holds it all together. So it's pretty important that I make sure that I've got all of the glue in what I'm doing so far. Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Mortar without sand is simply just water and cement, which turns into slop. It's very easily broken. Okay. So what it's talking about there is what have I done so far? Have I kind of half-assed this process, or am I serious about it, right? So when a guy leaves my house, because that's where all my fist steps happen, they happen somewhere in my yard, either I got a fire pit or we're sitting in the garden or we're doing something like that, mostly because I believe I see and experience the flow of energy, and I want that stuff to dissipate out into the universe, because I don't want it confined inside my house. I don't want to sage my house. I don't want to deal with all that stuff. So we do it outside, preferably with a fire, so that all the negative juju can get burned off. And that's what happens. And then when we're done, I tell them, do this before you get home, when you get home, or as soon as possible. Because what I have seen over and over and over again is guys do not do returning home until a week later, and they've lost the experience of the fifth step that gets sealed in when you do this returning home. You do this returning home. I've had a guy, I did a fifth step one time, we wrapped it up at a church, and I had the guy's defects all written out, and I left it sitting on the page. Meeting was about to start in like 30 minutes, and I left him with his sheet, all of his defects, and I handed it to him. And I said, I want you to sit here for the next 30 minutes and read those over and over again and find out if that's the way that you want to live the rest of your life. 30 minutes later, I came back. I opened the door. There was a different guy sitting in the chair. Looked the same, but he was different. He looked at me and he said, Brandon, I don't want to be this way anymore. There is something magical about this cementing process to close out the fifth step that gets you to this place where, oh, okay, that's crap. I don't want to carry it with me anymore. And then we turn to page 76, and we have two paragraphs that are perfect. In the 12 and 12, they go into a long dissertation on what these things mean. I think they're two paragraphs because that's what they need to be. Okay. Page 76, the first paragraph is about the sixth step. If we can answer to our satisfaction those four questions that we just looked at, then we look at step six. We emphasize willingness being indispensable. And then there's a question that has one question mark and two questions. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all these things which we have admitted are objectionable? Second question first. If I've gone through this process of inventory, if I did the first step, if I did the second step, and I went to God in the third step, and I wrote out these pitiful inventories in the fourth step, and I've shared them with somebody else, has that process been enough for me to realize I don't want this shit anymore? Do I find the way that I've been showing up, drunk or high, clean or sober, in my life to continue on? The answer should be, at this point, if you've done the work properly, no, I don't want to be that way anymore. Then the second question, which came first, can God remove them all from us? Because if they're not objectionable, I'm not gonna want God to remove them from me. Okay? Got good news and bad news. They really never go away. They soften and your awareness becomes greater of them and your ability to harm others with it is lessened. Okay? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go of, we ask God to help us be willing. I usually, not every time, but I usually have guys sit on the sixth step. I tell them either you're going to act out in your defects or you're going to have some significant spiritual experience show up in your life. When that happens, either one of those, say the prayer. I don't want to tell you what it's going to look like, because if I tell you what it's going to look like, then I'm going to program your mind to only look for that. So something's going to happen. So my experience in the sixth step, the most profound one was the first time I went through the steps. I had this intent one morning. I was going to meditate on the mother of my children. And that was what I took into meditation as the thing I was going to focus on. And I sat there and I started meditating on it. And this other thought, my thoughts come in from this side. This other thought came crashing in. And it was trying to push the thought of the mother of my children out. kept crashing and crashing and crashing, and I kept pushing it away. No, I'm meditating on this. Eventually, I let it come in, and what happened is the craziest thing, and it I can't even explain the experience I had, but essentially, if you take all my defects, my desire to control, my desire to dominate, the fact that I needed women to love me and respect me, this desire to have all these relationships with strippers and all this stuff. And this one childhood experience came in and it connected it all. And I had this profoundly weepy presence of God that was so profound. So here's what's so fascinating to me. And so I have this experience. It happens that I go and I see my sponsor that night. It's a Wednesday night. We had just started this new meeting. And I tell him about this experience. And he says, okay, so what's your six-step experience going to look like? And I'm like, I don't know, but that was so cool. If it's anything like that, it'll be so profound. And he's like, okay, well, tell me that story again. So I tell him the whole story again, all the details. And he goes, do you think that was your six-step experience? I was like, huh. It was like that Bush commercial. Like, which one was that? Oh, yeah, right. So I had that experience. And so to this day, nobody else has had that, like, I mean, plenty of people have had that profound experience, but nobody's had that experience where they had it and they didn't really see it, right? So on Memorial Day, most people have their day off. What I did is I listened to 3 footsteps. You know, they're fun. But that's what I did. So I listened to one at 9 o'clock, I listened to one at 2 o'clock, and I listened to one at 6 o'clock. And then everybody got the returning home instructions, and every single one of them got the experience of the description and explanation of the sixth step and what they were supposed to do. So this week, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, a guy calls me, and he tells me about how he was absolutely, completely acting out at every single one of his defects that we had listed as a six-step defect when we went through inventory. And he had like the most terrible day and it was miserable. And I said to him, I was like, so what was your homework? And he explained the six steps, sitting on it until some experience happened. And I'm like, tell me the story again. So he tells me the story again and I'm like, okay, what was your homework? And he goes, you're clearly, you see something I don't. And I'm like, you bet I do. And so I said, I think that you're in the middle of the experience of acting out in your defects, and you should, because he's telling me, like, I gotta have God because I can't do this shit on my own. And I'm like, okay, so say the prayer. Because the instruction after the sixth step is to say the prayer in the seventh step. Literally the next day, another one of the guys that read his inventory to me on Memorial Day calls me, has the same experience. I ask him what his homework is. He tells me. Then I tell him, tell me the story. Like, two guys in a row are in the middle of this presence of God, God showing them how they show up all shitty in their life, and they can't even see it. We can be in the middle of some of the most profound spiritual experiences of our life and be absolutely blind to the fact that they're happening unless we have somebody to share it with. So I instruct them both. Go say the prayer. Okay? Now, we've got the seven-step prayer. It occupies one paragraph in this book. If you read the 12 and 12, they got a whole paragraph on humility, I think it is. But it's about a prayer. The seventh step is about this prayer. If you've gotten to this point and you had some sort of experience in the sixth step, you know you have to have God. You know there is no way out. There is no way to change. You cannot do it by yourself. And so the seventh step prayer is a begging of God. It says, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Because I now have seen it, right? I've gone through the inventory process. I've written all this stuff down and I see I got some good and I got some bad, right? I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in my way, in my way of usefulness to you and my fellows. Okay? What does that say? If God can use the defect, it ain't going anywhere. Okay? If it's useful.
Brandon likes to be the center of attention and likes to have people pay attention to him. What is God doing this weekend? He's using one of my defects to communicate to you. Okay? Brandon has reached a place in his life where he is somewhat free of judgment and what other people that are looking at him feel about him. I need that up here in front of you guys. That has not been removed. Okay? Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. It is the completion of the process of 3 through 7. This prayer closes the process. And because we said the third step prayer together, and I don't like you guys to be hanging out there with a bunch of bad juju of like God showing you who you are and how shitty you are, I would like to close the prayer with you guys, if you're okay with it. Would you like to do the seventh step prayer with me?
Yes.
All right, it's on page 76 in the second paragraph. If you don't already have your book open, prayer.
My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
The term recovery is frequently used by those with lived experience of having survived addiction. It's often used to suggest a process of change far beyond the removal of drugs and alcohol from an otherwise unchanged life. So when I think back over the first year and a half of my time in the 12-step fellowship, having worked some steps and made a bunch of amends and learned how to pray and not done much with step 10, but doing a lot of 12-step work with working with others, I noticed that the major part of this design, the Creator's design, that had changed at that point was my willingness to do whatever I had to do, not to never be in a position where I thought it was going to be the answer to my problem was putting a mind-altering substance in my body. But very little else had changed about my character. I was trying to be more patient, but I was still, you know, I wanted to be important. I had this need for respect. I had a need to be right all the time. I had this idea that my time was more valuable than other people's time. And I would try to control and manipulate situations by holding information out. So a lot of those things that had been practiced for a significant period of time were still a part of my makeup. And this depicts the process of moving through and beyond remission to refill oneself. So I wasn't on any type of mission to refill oneself or develop depth of character and propel myself towards relationships and contributions that reach beyond the egoic self. So in some recovery circles, remission, no drugs, without recovery, is even castigated as a shallow level of achievement. In such circles, remission is viewed as the temporary suppression of symptoms, a process of subtraction, removing the drugs and the alcohol, where recovery is viewed as the process through which the surviving person is transformed. Process of addition and multiplication. Remission, no drugs, no alcohol, can be an act of self-assertion sometimes, but recovery, this larger achievement of health and functioning, often comes through an embrace of one's grosser handicaps and transcendence of the egoic self. It involves the acceptance of one's own brokenness and the practice of restraint and moderation in our thoughts, feelings, and actions, and finding a purpose for one's survival, carrying the message. So, as my sponsor says, that we have design features, and the only way for us to deal with these design features is send them back to the manufacturer. That manufacturer being God. And our design features is what we were designed with, what we're working with. Some of the defects that I showed up with almost 14 years ago are still here. Some of them have gone into remission and come back on a periodic basis, and some have been cast out entirely. Another buddy of mine that I've gotten to know over the years says when he showed up, his character defects were roaring lions that were walking with him at all times, decapitating people and gouging people's eyes out. Now he's been sober for 37 years, and he says that they're still the same character defects, except now they're these little purring kittens that just walk with him. It's almost like the way the ego operates is so crafty and so subtle and so sly when you've been doing this work for a really long time that the way that it injects itself into your life changes. You know, I don't hurt a lot of people these days. I don't steal anything these days. But I still know how to manipulate these days. Right? These are important parts of me. Not important, but they've been practiced for a very long time, and they're very hardwired into who I am. The Big Book talks about this word objectionable. As long as what I'm doing creates value or the illusion of value, it's not going to be cast out. It's going to persist in some form. Things become objectionable when I'm not getting anything from them anymore. That's how it's easy for me to go from being willing to finding these things objectionable than being entirely ready to go to God in step 7. But step 7 for me and step 6 are no longer about getting anything removed. But it's really about, in all humility, on my knees, going to my Creator saying, my only hope for refuge and sanctuary from myself is you. That's it. My relationship with you. With all this egg on my face, I come to you over and over to embrace me, to live through me, to hold me in this space. And in that, I start to see the mercy and the grace that's inherent in our grosser handicaps and our character defects, because they're sitting me back down at the table with God. If I didn't have defects, because I don't have crack anymore, I don't have alcohol anymore. You know, I do have these life situations that aren't going my way sometimes, and I communicate with my higher power because I want some understanding or I want some different results, and I forget that my life's no longer my business. I just need to have a perspective about how I'm living, but I still get into the management business. I actually think I can consult with God, right? Which always blows my mind. I don't think he needs a consultant. And with all that being said, I finally have gotten to this place of understanding that these character defects are what create a need to have God in my life today. Because most of the circumstances that unfold in my life are tied, the root is, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, tied to a grosser handicap of mine has now placed me in this position where I'm experiencing a set of circumstances that I have deemed unpleasant. And therefore, I'm struggling. But within the struggle, there's a refinement of my character. There's a change and a transformation that takes place when I go to God over and over as the only solution that I have. So the seventh step really becomes the third step with teeth. It says in the third step that we abandon ourselves utterly to God. I'm starting to think that abandonment takes place in the seventh step. The seventh step is where I need God these days. It's in dealing with how I show up and how I interact with people. So I am very grateful for my character defects. I'm not a guy who works on my character defects. I submit to this process on a regular basis, but I wholeheartedly believe that I need to return to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer is going to change whatever needs changing at the time. And whatever doesn't need to be changed doesn't get changed. You know, and I still struggle with some of the same things I struggled with when I got here. Some of these things that I struggle with, like my desire to be important, you know, to, you know, that's a blameworthy trait at times, because what ends up happening is I try to impose my way of doing things in certain situations because I have all this experience and I've done this before, and if you guys would just listen to me, everything's going to be great. But that same defect that's driving that desire to be important, puts me in a position where I'm well prepared for a lot of things I have to encounter in life. And I take time to study, and I take time to read, and I understand through communication how things work. But the same thing driving all of those is this desire to be important. So it serves me in some situations, and it doesn't serve me in other situations. And that's okay. That's as it should be. But the longer I stay on this path, the more I realize that the very things that I want to have changed about me make me useful to other people. Like, I've had several experiences as a result of, you know, I had a defect that the grosser handicap was that my life was less than what I anticipated it to be if I didn't have a girl in my life to share it with. And so I was on this incessant journey to find a partner. And I would meet a woman, and all of a sudden it's like the addict's mind kicks in, and you're already like, you've been dating for like 2 or 3 weeks and you're already planning stuff out. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, you've decided, nah, she's not the one. But now you've got a person who's becoming attached, and you're realizing you need to practice rigorous honesty to get out of this. And so then you divulge all of that and you hurt somebody. Right, and this defect was just crushing me after my marriage fell apart, but it kept pushing me into surrender after surrender and amends after amends. I mean, I don't even want to report to you how many amends I've made in my 14 years that have to do with what, like in my first 3 years and in the year and a half immediately after my marriage. There's probably ballpark about 20 women that I had to make amends to in sobriety because of this grosser handicap of feeling like I am not enough without a woman. Like, if I am single, that means I have failed in some way, right? These are the belief systems that are guiding me, and they created all these experiences and all these amends, and they put me into the fetal position at times. And then now I've been in a relationship for the last 14 months, and all of those experiences I had have like contributed to me showing up entirely different than any other relationship I've been in. And I think that's how life works. We gain all these learnings as we go along. And sometimes we have to have the same experience over and over because we're just not learning what we're supposed to learn. And that tends to be painful and a source of suffering. But I wouldn't trade any of what I went through, because it was all based on character limitations. And in that time, I wasn't trying to practice the opposite. I hear people say practice the opposite of, you know, quality. You have character liabilities and you have character assets, and you want to practice your character assets all the time. I've never subscribed to that. I try to address each moment as it comes up, and sometimes I just fall way short. And I hold myself accountable. I have a daily accounting of what's going on, and then there are times when I have to have a reckoning. That's what ends up happening. I have my reckoning with my character, and I've always used the spiritual practices, the principles of the steps, along with prayer and meditation, and then disclosing what I've got going on in my life. That's the one thing I think is a game changer for me. I've never tried to hide this from anybody in my life. The men that are important to me, they know. And I got a few women that I'm really close to, and they know all this that as it's happening and unfolding. And so with all of that, if you're trying to remove your defects yourself or trying to practice the opposite, I get we need practice. But then what happens when the defects still show up is we fall into self-judgment. And I am convinced that one of the worst things for an addict or alcoholic is to sit in this state of judging yourself and wanting to change yourself. Because if you're completely ego-identified with what's going on inside of your mind, which is based on the way you're judging yourself, you cannot be conscious of the presence of a higher power at the same time. So if I set my ideals, well, this is the kind of person I want to be, and I know we have to have goals. I get all of that. If you set your ideals up here, I don't know, but a guy like me falls short every single time. And so there's a gap between how I show up and how I want to show up. And if I spend my time trying to close this gap, I can't be conscious of the presence of God in my life. I'm only conscious of Tarek in that time. And so what I do is I practice addressing each moment as it comes up. Sometimes I fall way short. I have a process to take responsibility and to repair the damage I've caused. And I'm quite aware of that part of me, that dark, if you watch Dexter, dark passenger. Everyone sitting in this room has a dark passenger. But I'm aware of my dark passenger, and I know I have the capacity to do certain things. But the more I talk about it, the more I acknowledge it, that it's a part of me, the more it becomes integrated in who I am. And the wild thing is I don't act out when I'm able to walk through that process and know that about myself. But when I'm ignoring it and repressing it, I tend to like act out in it. I don't know why it works that way, but that's the way it's unfolded in my life. So defects and the purpose that they serve is change entirely for me. Like, recovery is about step 6 and 7 at the end of the day. After you've been here a while, that's really, I mean, it's a huge part of it. And it is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I'm not downplaying it at all. I'm just giving you another way of looking at it, because I watch a lot of people beat themselves up and exist in states of self-pity, self-loathing, and self-judgment because they can't act differently. The idea is that we're going to practice a new way of life and a new way of living when our hardwiring shows up. It's a reason to need God. I'm all about anything that creates a need for God. And today, my defects are what creates a need for me to have a personal relationship for a God of my understanding. And it's an evolution. These steps are so short in our big book. You know, granted, Bill wrote the 12 and 12, you know, I think like 15 years later, after 1939, and we have a chapter in the 12 and 12 that goes more into depth, but he looks at it through the lens of the seven deadly sins, which is, made nothing wrong with that. I love that perspective. You know, I want to know the way I was created, and I was created in a specific way. You know, there's never been a version of this human being ever across all time. There's never been a version of you. You're the only version of that that's ever been created. Right, and so in one of the spiritual traditions, it says, "He who knows himself knows his Lord." And part of knowing yourself is understanding the way you're limited. And the way we're limited involves our grosser handicaps. And so it's almost a way, and this is going to sound very therapeutic, but falling in love with yourself, regardless of all the blemishes and all of the, you know, inadequacies and the lack of integrity. It's falling in love with yourself. And taking that to God, going back to the manufacturer on a regular basis. So I'm very grateful for the way I struggle with my character, but I also understand that the entire spiritual path is about being accountable for the way we show up. We don't wake up and say, well, you know, and that we have an intent to hurt anyone or create harm. But part of being human is you're going to be in collision with people sometimes. And you're going to fall victim to greed sometimes. And you're going to be disrespectful sometimes because you need something in a situation that you're not getting, whatever it is. But understanding those aspects of ourselves, instead of having this idea going into the seventh step that God is actually going to remove all this stuff as soon as you ask him to. He removes, like, I don't steal stuff anymore. All right? But my major way of, I steal time these days. I steal time. You know, I withhold information in order to control the outcome that I think should happen in a situation. So the same root, you know, like Bill Wilson his story talks about the character defects unlike any other way place. He says that root, and what's he say, root and branch? He says root and branch. And so stealing before I got clean and sober was a branch on the root, which is I'm going to take what I want when I want to be okay. I don't steal anymore. The branch, that branch is gone. But sometimes I still operate under the belief system that I'm going to get what I want to be okay. What do I have to do? I don't know if that's ever going to go away. It still shows up. It shows up infrequently, but it still shows up. And so this is what I meant when I was given the analogy or the metaphor, the defects being like lions when I showed up almost 14 years ago. And now they're purring kittens at my side. But the path of recovery, after you've been here a minute, it really is about these steps. Just I'm looking at it in a different way. I don't want to get stuck in thinking I can change myself. I can't. But I do understand that all of these defects can come. The reason I don't think they ever truly any of them get removed is they can always come back. And so I use the word remission much more than I do cast out or removed. My greatest character defect has been my addiction, right, to mind-altering substances. That's completely gone into remission. But what happens if I quit treating it? If I quit treating the problem? Treating the broken internal condition through spiritual practices and walking a spiritual path, do I believe that if I were to walk away from that it would be a short time later that I'm going to use an anesthetic to cope with life? Absolutely. So it's going to come back out of remission. Same thing happens here, I think, with the defects of character. But I know I'm not a guy that is going to say that label them as entirely bad. They create situations that are uncomfortable and we have to address, but they've always sent me deeper into my relationship with God, so therefore there's a significance to having them. And if you stay here long enough, I was a guy in the beginning, I didn't do anything around 6 and 7. I wasn't really aware of them. It was part of my hour returning home the first time I went through the steps. I did my hour returning home. I said my 7-step prayer, and then I started my 8-step list. And I remember the guy who would later become my sponsor came and gave a talk, and he spent the majority of his talk discussing 6 and 7. And I remember thinking, man, this guy needs to get off his ass and go help somebody. It's about step 12. It's about step 12. And now I understand in a completely different way that everything that we do here is about the refinement of our character. So I don't want to be misunderstood when it comes to what I'm saying. It's very important to examine our conduct as we show up in life, understanding that these things can bring us closer to God at the same time. If we go to God in all humility and say, take all of me, the good and bad, take away what stands in my way of being useful today, and grant me strength as I go out here to do your bidding. So some of God's bidding has been me acting out in defects because it created situations later. Like Brandon talks about this a lot. It's like, you know, what you're experiencing now, you don't really know the role it's playing until later down the road when you can put all the pieces of the puzzle together, and then you can say to yourself, oh, that's why that happened the way it did. And that has also been a description of defects and how they've worked. They created situations that played a role in a series of events that I could not understand until I was later down the road. So I'll end with this. The magic and the miracle of steps 6 and 7 happens in the actions of steps 8 and 9. And that's all I got on that. Do you want to roll on this step 8? You want me to? So as we roll into step 8, I have a question, and you're more than welcome to raise your hand if you know the answer. And if you're someone that's been around for a minute and actually knows the answer, don't say it right at the very beginning. What step do you guys think plays the most important role in us sitting here 80 some odd years after our fellowship was founded. What step do you think it was that everything was built on?
Throw it out.
12. All right. I'll tell you a little story. About a month ago, let me see if I can do some math here. About 86, is it 86 years ago? 1934? 66? 66 or 21? 87? 35. Yeah. 65 plus 28. About 86 years ago, a month ago, Mother's Day weekend, 1935, this guy, Bill Wilson, has been sober for roughly 6 months. And he left Towns Hospital with this idea of carrying the message. But when he left Towns Hospital, he left it with an answer, and he left it with a program, the six steps of the Oxford Group. And he gathered all the alcoholics he could, brought them back to his house, but nobody could stay sober. And so he has to go back to work, and he's packing his bags, and he's about to go off to Akron, Ohio. And Lewis is, and him are having a conversation, and Bill's like, I don't know if this is going to work. I can't get anybody to stay sober. And Lewis goes, Bill, you're sober. Before that, he'd gone to Dr. Silkworth and explained to Dr. Silkworth how he was having so much trouble sobering up any of these winos. Dr. Silkworth says, well, Bill, maybe you should spend more time talking about the hopeless condition of alcoholism before you try to present the solution of God. Maybe they're put off by the idea of God because they don't understand how grave and hopeless their condition is. So we talk about three things: problem, solution, program of action. And he goes off to Akron. And this is Saturday, the day before Mother's Day in 1935. Bill's business deal has gone bad. It's fell apart. He's got about $10 in his pocket, and he's walking around the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel. And he hears the ice that's being poured into the cups in the bar. And he's pacing back and forth, and he sees a phone directory. And then he gets the intuitive thought that maybe I should talk to another alcoholic. And so he goes to this directory calling all these people across Akron. Finally, he runs across this reverend named Walter Tunks, who connects him to this lady named Henrietta Seiberling, who knows someone in her church group, the Oxford group, that is suffering from alcoholism. And she calls over to Dr. Bob's house, and he's like curled up in the fetal position, nursing a hangover. And Ann, his wife, says, today's not a good day, but I'll bring him over tomorrow. So now we're Mother's Day, 1935. Ann and Dr. Bob show up to this lady's house, and Bill is there. And so as they walk in, they're about to walk into this little room in the house. You hear people call it a parlor, but I saw a picture of it not too long ago, and it's like a little tiny little room off to the side with two chairs in it. And so before he goes in, Bob turns to Ann and says, look, this guy's got 15, 20 minutes. That's all he gets. I don't want – people have been talking to me about my drinking for so long. I'm so sick and tired of it. Just come get me in 15, 20 minutes. Well, they sit down in this room, and Bill proceeds to talk not about Bob's drinking. Bill talks to Bob about his own drinking, Bill's drinking. And he explains to Bob the physical and the mental aspects of our problem. They end up talking until 11 o'clock that night. It was like 4 or 5 hours. It was the first time Dr. Bob had ever had someone explain to him what was wrong with him. Because Bob was in the Oxford group too. He tried every spiritual means at his disposal to get sober. He'd been dipped and dumped and done all these things. But he just didn't understand what was wrong with him. And Bill ends up moving in with Bob. And for the next 2 weeks, they talk about this program that they're going to build. And they talk about these Oxford group steps, and Bob has a problem with one of the steps. It's called restitution to those harmed. Bob says to Bill, look, I mean, I can dig all these steps, But this one step you got here about restitution that the Oxford Group uses, I've already destroyed my reputation. I'm not going to go around town trying to clean all this up. I don't want to lose my means of making money and then my family loses our home. I'm just not willing to do that. And so Bob liked all the program except making amends. And he had Bob tells Bill, hey, you can't live with me for the rest of your life, so we're going to have to find out if this thing works. So I'm going to go to this convention in Atlantic City, and we're going to put it to the test. And so as the story goes, Bob is drunk on the train before he even gets to Atlantic City. And he's in a blackout in Atlantic City for a couple of days, and then he returns, and he ends up at his office manager's house. And the office manager calls Bill and Ann, says he's drunk, come get him. And so they go and they get him, and they have to nurse him back to health, because he's got surgery on Tuesday. Okay. On Tuesday, he wakes up, and him and Bill Wilson are sharing a bedroom at this time. And he turns to Bill, and Bob says, Bill, I'm going through with all of it. Bill was just waking up and thought he meant that he was going to go through with the surgery. And to this day, we have no idea who that poor guy who was he was operating on that day, because Dr. Bob was a proctologist, which is anal rectal surgeon. So I'm sure his hands were shaking that day. So they dropped him off that morning for surgery. Ann and Bill go, you know, they're at home waiting on Bob to get done, and he doesn't come home. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. They're convinced he's out drunk. 11 o'clock that night, Bob walks in, and they're like, "Where have you been?" He's like, "I drove around all day making amends." He'd become willing to make his amends. So we sit here 80 some odd years later, not because of the 12th step, not because of the 9th step, not because of the 11th, first step. We sit here because of the 8th step, becoming willing to make the amends. In the 8th step, the alcoholic and the addict get free. I've watched over the years. For years, I thought that addicts and alcoholics had a problem with making amends. They have a problem scheduling the amends. That's the problem. That's a step 8 problem. You're not willing. Made a list of all people we would harm and became willing to make amends to them all. What does that word mean, all?
All? Anybody know what all means?
All. It means all.
You know, it's so fascinating. They could have used any word in the English language, and they picked the word all, and they used it twice in one step. And that's some shit, huh?
I think they meant all, guys. Yeah. And so, the people that we harmed, they get free in the 9th step. Because if you have good sponsorship, you're going to learn about some questions you need to ask while you're owning your harms. You take responsibility for your actions. These are the harms that I caused you. Did I leave something out? Okay, I had a handful of amends that went like this. I don't even remember what you're talking about, but let me tell you how you really hurt me. Those are not fun amends. When you show up for one reason and then they inform you of something else that you were not aware of and did not remember. So the important question is, did I leave anything out? And then the third question is, what do I need to do to make things right between us? Those are the three things we have to do.
So trivia question or trick question, or I don't know what it is. So if I stole $10,000 from you and I sit down across from you and I tell you that I'm really, really sorry that I stole $10,000 from you, is the amend done?
No.
When is the amend done? He just wants his fucking money. The amend is not complete until you do what it is that they ask you to do of making it right. Yeah. Amend means to make whole. Not to apologize, to make whole.
So there's another question I left out is, do you need to tell me how any of this makes you feel? And that's the question where they get free. They get to finally tell you how your selfishness, your inconsideration, all the things, your addiction, all of it did to them. Right. And before we get into telling amends stories, I want to stay focused on step 8 and this idea that the approaches are so important. So when I take someone through step eight, they're going to make a series of note cards. And I can email all this to Roscoe so he's got it if he doesn't already have it. But the note cards are meant to create four lists. The lists are the people that you're going to make amends to right now, the people you're going to make amends to later, the people you might make amends to, and the people you're never going to make amends to. And so it's always good news, right, when I tell a sponsee, there's a never list you got access to, and you can put them on the never list. Because what sponsees inevitably do is they get to this step and they just sit and they become narcissistic about the worst amends they have to make. That's all they can think about is the very worst ones. I'm dealing with it with a sponsee currently. I'm like, dude, I don't care if that's the last amends you make. I need you making some amends. Just put it off to the side. So in the note card system, we do a plus minus. Plus plus means I know how to find this person and contact them, and I'm willing to make it. Plus minus means I'm willing to make this, but I got to do some research on how to contact them. Minus plus means I'm not willing to make this, but I know how to contact them. And minus minus is I'm not willing and I don't know how to contact them. We sort through it and we focus on the ones that you're willing to do and you know how to contact. But what ends up happening over the course of time, at least what happened to me, is the ones that are on the later list or start moving into the now list. The ones that are on the maybe list start moving into the later or the right now list, and the ones on the never list slowly come off. It's unfolded that way for everyone I've taken through the steps that have made amends. Now, look, I got here when my first eight-step list had almost 150 people and institutions on it. And then as I sat in meetings over the next several years, somebody would tell a story, and I'd be like, oh, no, I got to add another one to the list. I ended up with 230. It took me 8.5 years to approach all of those 230. Now, I couldn't make 230 amends because of the 230 that I approached, I don't know what the number is, 40 to 50 never responded back, right? And then a bunch of them had this response: I'm glad you're doing well, but I never want to see you again. Or I'm glad you're doing well, I'm not interested in making this amends. And so a lot of them, you know, weren't actually sit down, but what I'm driving home here is step eight. I approached them. I contacted them and tried to schedule an appointment. When it was all said and done, and I actually made a financial amends 2 months ago. I've paid back now. I think I just broke the $25,000 mark in the entire time I've been clean and sober. I'm still not done making amends. A lot of the money I'm paying back now, you guys are going to love this one. I had a lot of people that I owed money to. When I showed up to make amends, they wouldn't take the money. So what have I been doing? I kept all the note cards. I've been donating the money. Whenever I can, I donate the money. I go to the note card until it's done, and I move on to the next one. I've got $10,000 left. I'm going to keep making them. Keep donating money whenever I can. Because these are people that didn't want their money. But a lot, I've had sponsees show up and say, oh, they didn't want their money. I'm like, so what are you doing with it? They don't like the conversation. But since I have personal experience with what I'm talking about, we're going to have the conversation. It's not your money to begin with. We always think we're giving people our money. No, we're giving them back their money. And we don't. That's a hard pill for us to swallow. But then you're asking yourself, what does this have to do with me sticking a needle in my arm? And my question to that is always, not question, well, yeah, a question. Are you willing to pray and ask your Creator if making these amends has anything, if not making these amends has anything to do with me getting high again? If you want to be serious about it, let's just start praying about it. That will uncover how free do you want to be. That's what that will uncover for you. You know, how much of God do you want in your life? One of my favorite mentors or guys he's passed away now that influenced me, that was his big thing I hear him say. How free do you want to be? You know, if God is the ocean and you got something you got some type of container, you can go to the ocean with a thimble and you're going to get a thimble full of water, or you can back up a goddamn dump truck to the ocean and get all of that you can. This ties in directly to what you're going to do with these amends. In my almost 14 years of going to a lot of meetings in a lot of different states and a lot of different countries, I have been to very few meetings on nine-step amends. Why do you guys think that is? Why are, I mean, we're always in a step one meeting, a step 12 meeting, a step three meeting. Every now and then I get a sprinkling of a step six and seven meeting, but it is rare that I go to a meeting on step eight and nine. Why is that? Very few people make all their amends. Very few people set out to make all their amends.
As a result of my first step experience and the hope I experience in steps 2 through 5, I am eager to take the exact nature of my wrongs to God in steps 6 and 7. I want them removed so I can stay sober and be free of the things that have caused me failure and defeat. Without a first step experience, I will see these steps as mere stepping stones for bigger and better things to come. I am much more willing to make a list of all the people I have harmed, and much more willing to finish my amends as a result of experiencing the seriousness of my malady in step one. It will become crystal clear that I will die if I do not go to any lengths to repair the damage I have caused. If my experience in step one was an intellectual one, I have a casual attitude about making amends. I will tell myself that I will make these amends when the situation presents itself, or I may convince myself that I will not die if I drink again, and I can always get sober again. I'll tell you guys, from my own experience and the experience I've seen in others, you got some unfinished amends with some females? Watch what happens when you attempt to get relationships with females. If you're having trouble making money, ponder your mind, peruse your 8-step list, see if you owe anybody money. Having trouble getting a good job? Maybe there's an employer that you owe an amends to. It is amazing to me how the spiritual realm works. You can't get something new until you take the old thing back and clean it up. You want to have a greater, more magical life? This is where it shows up. And here's the other thing that I found. That those defects that we're trying to soften or lessen that are in step 6 and 7, you know what it sounds like when they're being removed or lessened? I'm here to make things right with you. And when you sit across from another person and you get to see how the actions that you took in your self-centered, selfish behaviors, how they affected those other people, it starts to lessen those things. You start to see in living color, right in front of you, on the facial expression of the person you're sitting across from, what you do to the world. That is a great motivation for change. That is a great motivation for me to maybe not come across so strongly when I experience people. To maybe not try to get so much out of the world. To maybe not try to get that little bit of extra money out of somebody. Because here's what I know. The universe keeps track of it all. And if I still owe some people money or I'm still screwing people over... Who in here believes in karma? Okay. Who in here believes what goes around comes around? Okay. Just for your information, it's the same thing. So, if karma is simply the result of past actions, that's it. So, in the spiritual realm, if you take something out, you can't get more until it is returned. This is where that happens, and this is where you start to grow and to get the things that you think you want, which you later learn you don't want anyways, but we'll talk about that later.
All right, we're going to break until 6 p.m.